Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name's Lisa Krieger, science and environment reporter for the San Jose Mercury News and Bay Area News Group. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Anthony Barnowski and Dr. Elizabeth Hadley, and they're authors of a new book called Tipping Point for Planet Earth, How Close Are We to the Edge? Dr. Barnowski is professor of integrative biology, curator of fossil mammals in the Museum of Paleontology at UC Berkeley. Dr. Hadley is the Paul S. and Billy Achilles Professor in Environmental Biology and Senior Associate Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education at Stanford University. She's also a Senior Fellow at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment and a Leopold Environmental Leader. Prior to joining Stanford, she was research professor at Montana State University and also a paleontologist at Yellowstone National Park. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Anthony Barnowski and Dr. Elizabeth Hadley.
Thank you, Lisa, and thank you, Georgette, also for getting everything arranged, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club as well. And I also want to extend my thanks to you guys for showing up and coming to hear what we have to say. So I'm going to start, and we're going to do a little bit of a tag team. So I'm going to start, and then I'll hand the talk over to Tony for a little bit. I'd like to open with this slide. Maybe many of you used to follow Commander Scott Kelly when he took photos from space, from the space station. And it's, you know, it's this beautiful reminder of really how fragile the planet is, how tiny it is against the vastness of space. But even from the space station, from far away, you can see human imprint. And if you haven't gone to see his images, I really encourage you to do so, because they are profound in the sense that the Earth is extraordinarily beautiful, but it's also really impacted by humans. And so one of the things I want to we both want to do tonight is we want to talk a little bit about some of the stories in our book and how those stories have come to kind of come together to have us ask this question about tipping point for planet Earth. Our research has taken us around the world. This is a picture on the left here of this animal called a pika. If you hike high elevation regions in the American West, you'll see the American pika. But in Asia, there are about 28 species of pikas, and they're concentrated around the Himalayas, shown over there on the right side. This mountain range, on average, is around 15,000 feet, and these animals are very diverse and live at extraordinary elevations. In order to study them, you have to spend a lot of time hiking, and one of my colleagues is in the audience who actually hiked on Uma Ramakrishnan from India, who hiked up there with me. And as you hike in this environment, you are in the land of the red panda. This is the last kind of vestige of the home of the red panda. This is what kind of the hike looks like on the right side. These are some of the Himalayan peaks. And there's a story about why these trees don't have a lot of branches that you'll have to read in the book. But I want to tell you about what happens when you spend days and days hiking away from the urban area, Kathmandu. You can't drive to these places. It's all a matter of hiking, basically straight uphill. In order to do that, you stay in these homes of the local people. And this is a woman. She's a very young woman. They have children very young. This is her baby. And she runs this thing called a tea house. It's just a little room with food. And then there's a couple of beds for you to stay in. This is what the room looks like in the evening when she fires up the stove. And just as a little kind of precursor, the wood from this stove is gathered from the trees that you saw on the previous slide. And, you know, you sit there and you're faced with this really very hand-to-mouth existence. These people are very close to the resources. Every bit of rice, every bit of all the lentils, everything you eat comes on the back of some of the people, of these people that have hiked that up as far as you have. But there's something else. And this is outside this woman's home. This is a box about this big. And for those of you who may not recognize this, this is a solar panel. And it sits out on one of these sticks from the branches from the trees, and someone goes out and rotates it around to follow the sun all day long. And what that solar panel charges is not power. There's absolutely no power in these tea houses. There's no lights. It powers their cell phones. So people, even this far away from civilization, days of hiking, no beasts of burden, no roads, no bicycles, they all have cell phones. So they know what's happening in the world, and they have remained connected to each other across mountain ranges because of the cell phone. So one of the questions that over and over again as we went out into the world, we began to ask ourselves, are these people that are living so close to the land really a sign of our future, or are they a sign of our past? And it made us wonder, where are we going? The very first thing that we have to talk about is people. There are a lot of us. And if you haven't seen this curve, you really should go back and look at it a little bit. The red curve the curve is showing us to the year 2100. If we were to follow that red curve, which is our present global fertility rates, we would be well over 20 billion people on the planet. And I'll just tell you, there's absolutely no way we can have that many people on the planet. If we were to manage to just replace ourselves, two parents for two children, we'd end up with the blue line. That's the median growth. And even then, we're over 10 billion people. The only way to stave off 10 billion people is if we somehow took global fertility rates and around the entire world, reduce them to 1.5 children per parents. So basically, we all of us, we're almost certainly headed for 10 billion people, and we all need resources. We all need food and water. And this is happening as climates are changing. And the civilizations, the areas that we've built up, and human civilizations around the world have evolved in the last 10,000 years, are being threatened. They're being drowned by sea level rise. They're being threatened with unstable infrastructure by dramatic storms. And even in our country, even close to our home, this is costing us billions of dollars. And it's difficult to plan for these catastrophic events. Globally, ecosystems are disappearing, and these ecosystems provide ecosystem services. They provide clean water. They provide buffers from sea level rise. They provide wood, resources for us. 51% of Earth's land surface has been impacted by humans. We are co-opting the resources and that land for our consumption, for our livelihood. In fact, if you look at how much land has been influenced by humans, it's 83% of the planet. What you see in purple here is what we've done a really good job co-opting resources from. What's left are the tougher places, the Arctic, the central Amazon, the Congo, two places that have some of the most biodiverse kind of regions on the planet, and places like the Sahara. So if you look at this, you realize we've already taken the low-hanging fruit for our own use. We're left with basically big challenges and big decisions to make about the rest of the planet. We need water. If you look at where population density is the highest, and that's in parts of Asia and India and China, in parts of Africa, we all need water. And there are already, all of these areas are majorly threatened by the amount of water. India has recently been in a drought, so much so that not only are people asked to avoid cooking during the day in a place where there's some of the best food on the planet, but there's no power for much of the day. The same thing is happening presently in Venezuela because of lack of water. And at the same time, we need to feed people. And not only do we need to we basically need to be more efficient with our food, we are going to be forced to co-opt areas that have never been farmed to farm them. And the example here in Africa shows that areas in red are going to be declined. They're going to be abandoned as farmland because of climate change. And what they'll have to do is co-opt new areas, and those are shown in the green in Africa. And if you look on the other side of the figure, on the right side, you'll see in the purple, those are the areas that have the highest biodiversity in the continent. So exactly where we need to kind of anticipate our needs for the future is exactly where we'll have to make some tough choices about conservation of wild places. So the point about this, and we elaborate much more in the book, but the point about this is that there are a synergy of impacts, all of which lead to some sort of tipping points. So for example, there is disease. There are invasive species and invasive diseases. The example here is showing is from the Rocky Mountains, where the bark beetle is basically decimated in some places up to 80% of the forest. Forest gone. The Rocky Mountain forest from Alaska down to Mexico, parts of that forest, 80% of it are gone in just a decade. Climate change, clearly. This is a glacier from the top of Kilimanjaro. A glacier on the top of Kilimanjaro. There are a few of them left, and they'll be gone in our lifetime. Pollution is impacting the world. You read about pollution in Beijing, but that's not the only place. It's all over Asia. It's even in our country, South America, and elsewhere. And then ocean acidification and dead zones. Those are clearly happening. And the other point that we really want to emphasize as biologists is that protected areas, those areas where the biodiversity is really high, are increasingly isolated from one another. And when you throw these human threats on top of those basically smaller and smaller reserves, it means that all of our wild animals and plants are isolated from each other. They're isolated from their gene pools. They're isolated from other individuals. And what that means is a slow erosion of biodiversity. Now I want to hand it to Tony to explain a little bit about tipping points.
So it's my job to break the egg here. So I also want to thank everyone for coming tonight, and to thank Lisa and Georgette for organizing this. But what Liz has just pointed out to you really is the state of the world, and it looks pretty dire, right? However, as we'll get to, there are bright spots. And the point that we want to make tonight and that we try to make in the book is that we really are balanced on the edge of where we could go towards the bright spots, or we could continue on the present trajectory, which, as we'll show you, is not really what we want to do. When we talk about tipping points, we're actually using that in a fairly formalized way in terms of the way scientists use it, and that is an irreversible change. I mean, we've all experienced tipping points. You probably experienced one this morning if you boiled water for your tea and saw the water go from water to steam when you hit that critical temperature. That's one sort of tipping point. We're talking about a state change, but that's a tipping point that you can reverse if you just cool down the steam. So we're seeing those sorts of things on the planet. The kinds of tipping points that we're really concerned with, though, are what happens when this egg rolls off the edge of the table. That's another kind of tipping point, and that's an irreversible change, right? Each one of those individual causes that Liz just, or each one of those individual effects that Liz just pointed out to you represents a tipping point in itself. If we go too far, you know, it's irreversible with climate. If we go too far, it's irreversible with using up farmland and so on. But the real worry is if you put them together, they interact. So when you get a lot of seemingly unrelated causes coming together in certain ways, that's where you get the big planetary tipping points, and those are the sorts of tipping points we're talking about. And you actually don't have to look into the future to see those. We've all heard, been hearing over and over again through the past year about the global migration crisis as expressed by refugees pouring into Europe. If you think about how that came together, that's not an isolated cause, okay? You can We think of it as, okay, a war-torn region. People are fleeing the war-torn region, and they are. But if you back up and say, okay, what made that happen, you can start playing games like this, okay? So if you read that list of countries across the bottom, those are the countries that have contributed most migrants in the world over the past 20 years. It's a who's who of conflict zones, right? Now, if you take a look at that blue line, that represents the average global population growth over those 20 years. Those yellow bars are showing you that in each one of those war-torn countries, local population growth was 2 to 3 times the global average. So these are the population growth hotspots, or have been over the past 20 years. That in itself is actually not enough to cause wars. There's another ingredient there, of course, which is these are all areas that have deep histories of ethnic and religious rivalries. But those are typically held in check, unless some other things happen. So just winding up a little closer to the present, 2014, those arrows show you the countries that were contributing the most migrants by then. And now, of course, Syria is at the top of the list. And if we just take Syria as a case study and think about what led to people pouring out of there, this is what happened. One of the worst droughts to hit the Middle East in a century or so. And that's an effect of the global climate change issues that Liz mentioned earlier. Take a look at that graphic on your right there, and you're going from the year 1900 to the year, 2015. And those bars are showing you mean yearly temperature. The line going across is the average over that time. And you can see that early on, lots of cool years. And then you get in the middle, lots of fluctuations, hot years, cool years, hot years, cool years. That's actually classic complex systems behavior, where you flip from one state to a brand new state. Then we flip into our present hotter state, and it gets warmer and warmer and warmer. And the result of those high temperatures going towards the right of that graph is the farm field you see the fellow kneeling at. Okay, so now we've got a situation, high population growth, deep-seated rivalries, and a drought that means a crash in food and water supplies. People pour into the cities. Life is no better there. No food or water there. And people get mad. And even an iron hand like Assad's can't hold that sort of boiling cauldron together. That's why we get the rise of ISIS. That's why people are fleeing for their lives. So that now, if you look at what's going on, there's a map of Europe. Those high bars show you basically hundreds of thousands of people pouring into Europe, primarily from Syria, but from several other countries in the Middle East as well, in those war-torn regions. Literally millions of people seeking asylum. Point though is it's not just Europe, okay? If you look at the neighboring countries around Syria, they're receiving more migrants than Europe is. And it's not just the Middle East. This is out of the news last week, all right? India, right now, experiencing their worst droughts in 40 years. Tens of thousands of people are leaving the countryside, pouring into some of the major cities, just as happened in Syria. You know, human trafficking is going up. In Venezuela, Liz mentioned another drought. They're down to a 2-day work week now because the reservoirs are dried up and they can't generate the power to keep the lights on. So these are the things that are happening, okay? And if you start putting two and two together and start thinking, all right, let's roll the clock forward to 2050, going as we have kind of leads to a lot more scenes on the right side of the picture there, more conflict, more things we don't like to think about. What we really want to do is turn the world into something that looks more like the left side. So, we're not naive here. We know there's never going to be utopia. We know that there's always going to be conflict zones. But the point is, if we don't want to go into a future where those conflicts become more frequent than they are today, and we'd rather go into a world where we're going to start building on the good things and expanding those, we have to think about doing things differently, okay? And that's where the solutions come in. And it actually isn't all gloom and doom at all. As I said, there are lots of bright spots out there. We know exactly what we have to do. Those are four big things, and we'll probably, for lack of time, just focus a little bit on the first three, but halting climate change, we actually know how to do that. Stabilizing population growth, we know how to do that. And increasing global cooperation, we kind of know how to do that. And it's all very feasible, okay? People are really, really clever. We already have the technology to hit the climate change issue, for example. We know how many machines we have to build, and we know that we can do that within the time left for us to turn things in the direction we want. We know how to fix the population problem. And, there's actually three ways to fix the population issue. All right, one of them I guarantee you that nobody in this room wants. And that's what happens if we keep shooting up on that red line that Liz showed you. At some point, it's, just like paramecium in a test tube. You cause a population crash through all the bad things I was talking about. We don't want to go there. Another way is what China did, a one-child policy. That worked, but introduced a lot of social problems and other issues that are just coming to light now. About the same time that China had their realization about population, Mauritius was experiencing pretty much the same thing, a small African country. They went at it in a very different way and said, let's empower women. Let's make sure they have access to education. Let's make sure they have access to that people have access to contraceptives if they want them. Their population growth rate shot down every bit as rapidly as China's, and now Mauritius is one of the economically best off countries in Africa, one of the highest qualities of life, and so on. And that pattern repeats over and over and over. So, bringing education to parts of the world where it presently isn't available. We know that works. Turns out most of those places are in developing countries, and I will pass the baton back to Liz here.
So one of the insights, I mentioned to you the solar panel. And one of the other insights that I've learned by traveling to these faraway places is that people will innovate. They're not waiting for some big tech companies or some eggheads like us from universities. They're not waiting for their government. They figure out how to make things work the way they can. And one of my favorite examples is this hospital, which is at the base of Mount Everest. This hospital is entirely powered by micro hydro and solar. It has an operating room. It has a place to get x-rays. It is one of the most important places for women to go to have children in the area. Do we have a single hospital that is micro, hydro, and solar power operated? So the point is even though this particular place is so far away, these areas, by necessity, are inventing things that we are reluctant to adopt. And the reason is because the Western world sees a big distance between the way we're living now and the way these people are living. The point is that we have to really think outside of the box we're used to into novelty. The other positive thing in terms of global cooperation, and one that's really changed even since we wrote our book, is that world leaders are really starting to lead. They're stepping up to the plate. I have to say this isn't true for everyone, but there are bright spots all over the world. Obama has finally come out talking about climate change. Governor Brown, our governor, is just unbelievable with respect to how far he has spread the message of climate change. In advance of Paris, the COP meetings in December, Governor Brown and his staff managed to get 130 subnationals, so these are states, regions, urban areas, to sign the Under 2 MOU. And combined, these subnationals are the largest economy in the world. Everybody at the higher level was talking and arguing about points, and in the meantime, Governor Brown just left the state of California and said, "Do you guys know about climate change? If you're not doing something about it, you should be." He's been a remarkable leader around the world. And it's not just the Pope that's made this. Actually, every major religious leader has made a point about the ethics, morality, and our obligations to stave off some of these problems. I think the big message is that solutions take social innovations. You know, it's not just about technology, and it's not just about data. I'm a scientist, and I would say that we don't necessarily, I don't think we need more data to tell the world we're in trouble. It's even economically, I mean, there are definitely economic advantages to shifting off of fossil fuels. But even economically, we abolished slavery, which was a tough decision to make at the time, and economically we sacrificed for that, but it was a major social innovation, and it was disruptive and very important. The solutions really begin with you. They begin with conversations you have around your dinner table with your friends, and the reason we know that is important is because many studies have shown in societies that 20% of people just care about themselves. They're just going to do what they want. They're going to do the best they can for themselves no matter what. 20% just don't want to engage. They don't care about anything. They're just doing their own thing. We call those free riders. But 60% of the people, and often this is the silent majority, can really are at the edge. They're at a tipping point of decision. And so those conversations, that engagement, that spreading the word is really, really important for the majority of people in our social networks. We learned about this. I mean, Tony and I have been excavating fossil sites and studying mammals for years. And we learned about the importance of this when we wrote a paper in 2012, along with several other co-authors. And this paper was published in Nature, and it got a lot of press, including on the San Francisco Chronicle. But it also was spread to news articles around the world. This is an article from Le Monde in Paris, and that article was read by these two people, Cyril Dion and Melanie Laurent. And Melanie at the time was pregnant with her first and only child at this point. And she said, "I can't bring a child into this world unless I know I've done something to make a difference." She's an actress. She's been in Inglourious Basterds, and she's in the new movie By the Sea with Angelina Jolie. But they came together and they crowdsourced a movie called Demain. So the point of this movie, and it's just amazing that it goes back to a science paper we wrote, but this is just one example of how disseminating knowledge and having conversations has made a difference. This movie has won the French César. It's won two film festivals for documentaries in the U.S. It has been seen by well over a million people, and it's a remarkable. It's changed people's communities, and I guess our conclusion is that we really know enough to act. It just is up to us to do so. And with that, I'd like to thank everyone for coming and listening, and we'll be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Liz and Tony. Really recommend the book. It's depressing, sobering, and inspiring also. I guess first, there's news out of Nepal today that maybe you could address that is relevant to this. Just when I was walking in, you were telling me, and for those of you who have traveled to Asia, it's very emblematic of what's happening.
So I have to say I don't know the gory details, because right when Lisa was walking in, I was reading I tweet a lot, and I find out a lot of information on Twitter, and I had just seen an announcement that said that there were people at work in Nepal trying to overthrow the government. And then I immediately messaged one of my friends there and said, "What's going on?" And he said, "There'll be a new government in a day or two." Now, this is a place, there are lots of forces that are working in Nepal. They're recovering from an earthquake, so resiliency is really important there, and not just because of climate change, but because of the building and the infrastructure. It's a very poor country, but Kathmandu is actually the fastest urbanizing city in Asia. So the pressures are remarkable. They have no oil whatsoever. They have no fossil fuels, so every bit of it they import. They have no port. So they're squeezed between these superpowers of India and China, and they're essentially at the whim of whatever the trade agreements are between those countries for their resources. They're long petrol lines. You have ration cards for your cooking gas, and power is only on in the winter for one or two hours a day. And then finally, you're at the base. You just came back from Bhutan. You're at the base of the Himalayas. You could see Mount Everest from Kathmandu, but most of the winter months, you can't see the mountains at all because of air pollution.
And litter, you're saying, on the most beautiful trails. So, a question that came up in my mind reading the book was about the carrying capacity of the world. And those of us who grew up with Paul Ehrlich and the population bomb remember that it seemed imminent, it just collapse. And that wasn't the case then. And he's been challenged on that point. But now population's again an issue. And do we know how? You're talking 10 million. How is it that is the end point? Talk about the math behind that a little bit.
Sure. So, people have been thinking about this for a long time, and Paul's is a classic work. And I guess the latest thought is that if we had no additional technology to increase our carrying capacity, 2 billion people on the planet would be a reasonable number, okay? Now, we do have technology, so carrying capacity actually is a lot higher than 2 billion. And the question is, when do we reach that point when our technology will no longer save us? One of the reasons that Paul and Anne's most dire worries did not come to pass was because of the Green Revolution. Remember, the population bomb was written back in the 1960s. At that time, it was absolutely clear that billions of people would be dying of starvation by the 1980s if food production was not done differently. That brought together a world effort, cooperation of governments, economists, NGOs, scientists, and we did it, all right? Now, Norman Borlaug, who was the architect of that, if you will, when he received his Nobel Prize for saving a billion people, said, look, we haven't solved the problem. We postponed it by about 30 years. That's where we are now, okay? So now we're in this second ramp up, or actually continued ramp up. And as Liz showed you in those great graphics, we're pretty much out of the low-hanging fruit as far as food production and so on. So, you know, the short story is there probably is a carrying capacity. We don't quite know what it is, but people have also done calculations that look at the amount of primary productivity that people require, and then how much is left over for all the other species on the planet, and calculated what the trade-off is. And basically, when you hit about 15 billion people, things start to decline really rapidly for all the other species on the planet. So I would say that 15 billion is a number we don't want to go above.
I would say, I want to add to that a little bit and say it's not just the number of people that matters. We actually have many more times the commensal animal biomass on the planet than we do human biomass. And so the cows, the chickens, the horses, all of those animals, the biomass of those animals, the majority of animal biomass on the planet. And so it's not just our living, it's actually the growing the food that many of us enjoy eating. And the other thing I'll say is that while all countries really benefited tremendously from the Green Revolution, there's one country, or one continent, that didn't, and that's Africa. And there are really interesting reasons why not. A lot of it has to do with the number of countries and the fact that each country kind of conserves a different kind of resources. There's some that are really dry, some that have lots of water. There's not a lot of infrastructure that supports exchange between them, and all sorts of other reasons. But that is one place where there's a lot that we can do, and it's a very important part of the planet to do it.
Thank you. Related question from the audience, which is a great one, is the population growing due to new births, or is it because people are living longer?
It's both, and of course, population isn't growing equally all over the world, obviously. But the basic hotspots of population growth tend to be in the poorest parts of the world. Primarily, Africa is the big one right now. And the reason for that is actually pretty much the same reason that we saw population growth starting to ramp up a lot in the 60s, and that is a lot of areas are now attaining basic necessities that mean that more of the children that are born into a family actually do live to adulthood and have families of their own. So there's this lag time in the cultural perception, right, where, you know, the basic mode of operation in those countries is if you want a couple of your kids to grow to adulthood and reproduce, you had to have six or eight, right, because of infant mortality and childhood mortality. Bringing in this basic level of health care that allows more survival means population ramps up really fast. People live longer in addition. So you get this big population bulge, and then it's taken a while for the cultural norm to catch up and say, oh, I don't really have to have six kids anymore. I can have two kids and have the same effect.
So I just want to add that it's, you know, it's not fair to blame developing countries on the population. It's more than just population. So the bottom 3 billion people on the planet use 5% of our greenhouse gases. The top 1 billion, that's us in this room, use 60% of our greenhouse gases. So it's not just population, it's our footprint too. And that global footprint is really important. You put that together with the number of people on the planet, and it matters. Part of the reason why population growth in these developing regions is so important and something to consider is because they do create, there is this lack of infrastructure in many of these countries. And when there aren't the basic necessities to feed and to give water to people, people will move. There are no walls, no matter how big or who pays for them. that will keep people out. I mean, some of the most amazing things about the exodus from Syria is that people have gone all the way through northern parts of Russia and come in through Scandinavia on bikes. I mean, there's no way to limit migration. We have absorbed 17 million migrants in North America from Central America and Mexico. So I think that's a really important thing to remember. The other thing is that population density and the pressures of populations, those resources, we need to handle those needs there. This is where global cooperation is so important. The other reason is because they surround many of our biodiverse regions. So if we care about the mountain gorilla, the 700 mountain gorillas that are left, we have to think about population growth in Rwanda, the most densely populated country in Africa, where the average fertility rate is between 8 and 10.
Interesting. A related question about why population growth is really not part of the focus of as a solution to climate change. You don't hear much about it, and ditto for environmentalism in general. Environmentalists have steered clear of the topic.
I mean, I think there's one obvious reason for that is that it's a political hot potato, right? but you know, the other reason is because, as Liz said, in connection with climate change, it actually is the top billion that produce 60% of the problem. The poorest 3 billion produce 5% of the problem. In a way, that's kind of good news, because the very people that are producing the problem are the ones that have the technology and the economic wherewithal to fix it. And it's kind of interesting to think about, all right, how much money would it actually take to bring those porous 3 billion up and the, you know, those intervening ones to a standard of living that would be much better than what they presently experience? And what would we have to sacrifice to do that? Well, the answer is, if we shift over to a energy production system that does not rely on fossil fuels, that is green energy, that solves both of those problems. The developing world actually has the technology to help, sorry, the developed world has the technology to help the developing world leapfrog and never even go through the fossil fuel phase. And in terms of cost, if each one of us, top 1 billion, contributed $700 per year, that does it. Okay?
So it, contribute to who?
However you want to do it, a tax, whatever.
Okay. The cost of the problem.
A global fund to change world energy system and help developing countries develop to the degree they wanted to develop. That's $700 for each of us per year. I think we could do that.
So I want to say another reason to answer your question about why population isn't discussed. Well, I mean, all of you can probably, you know, we've been working on evolution, climate change, and now we talk about population. Those are three hot-button political items or political issues. But I can't underscore enough how important education is. I mean, you don't see, you know, especially educating girls. And there are all sorts of hypotheses about why this is so, but not only does it dramatically, the number of years that girls spend in school is directly related to the number of children they have. It's an inverse relationship. And not only that, it's not just a personal change. It's not just fertility rate for that individual or those collective individuals. It actually causes an increase in GDP for those countries that they're in. And so there's two trade-offs there. And the irony to me, and actually one of the saddest things about ISIS, which is a brutal, horrible thing, is that they directly are targeting women's education. And whether or not they know this relationship and they're deliberately trying to increase the birth rate in the countries that they're dominating or not, I don't know. But it is very interesting that the trying to keep prevent women from being educated is one of their modes of war.
Wow. Several questions about the tipping point, which are really interesting. One raises the question, how do you figure we have time and that change can be irreversible before you've tipped? Do we have time, I guess, is the question. How much? And then a question I had of what would it look like if the world goes over the, God forbid, goes over the edge? You know, do the horsemen of the apocalypse gallop in? Two related questions.
Which one would you like to answer?
Yeah.
So Tony and I have discussions about this a lot, and I'd say that a lot of times I end up on the depressing side of the story, and he's more of an optimist about this than I am. But I still am out there talking to as many people as I can, and I really believe that we can make a difference. And the reason I do is because I have these friends in places like Nepal that live without power. They still have a computer. They're still connected with the world, but they don't live with the kind of stuff that we've become used to. So I know it's possible. And I also know that one person can make an enormous difference. I've been surprised and incredibly amazed by how active the U.S. military is in these issues. And if you haven't read some of the gray literature that comes out of these think tanks that are military think tanks, I'll tell you, your minds will be blown. These people, these retired admirals and generals, we've met with them more than once and talked to them about what they're thinking about. They think about global issues. They think about the time scale that we're talking about, the year 2050, the year 2100, the next decade. This is outside the realm of many political activities, but it falls directly in their lap. There's a disaster somewhere, whether it's a hurricane, whether it's war. The U.S. military is who people expect to go in and make a difference. So their thinking is remarkably far-reaching, and they get climate change. They have a whole new ocean. The Navy has a whole new ocean. It somehow has to patrol, protect, build stations there. I mean, they're thinking about how do they protect our business interests from going through the narrow Bering Sea. That's ripe for piracy, for example. They're thinking about things you can't imagine about. They're playing water games with retired leaders in Asia and asking them, what are you going to do when the glaciers in the Himalayas dry up? I just read right before we came in here that there's a military base, a Royal Air Force military base in the UK that has now completely been transformed for renewable energy. Some of the most biodiverse areas in North America are on abandoned military properties. So there are these places, these bright spots, these unexpected, you know, we can't just sit in our own political realm. You have to really be open to understanding, communicating, and thinking across what used to be kind of insurmountable boundaries.
Yeah. So, and I think that what Liz just pointed out is one thing that actually does make me think we're moving in the right direction and can do this thing. I mean, the people that we have interacted with in very high places, I mean, governor's office, in the White House, the military leaders that Liz has been talking about, they get it. They're trying. I think that's a bright spot. You know, we've been working on these issues for 25, 30 years, and we've actually seen the needle move more in the last 5 years than in the previous 30. So that's an indication to me that more of the general population is beginning to care about these things, which is the essential ingredient for things to happen at the top. And then the third thing I'll say, two more things I'll say. One is that, you know, these are not problems you solve overnight. These aren't sprints. They're marathons. So it's going to take 2-3 decades to actually move significantly where we want to be. So incremental change is going to be really important, and that's happening. And then the other thing is, you know, Liz and I... both teach university students, and these kids get it. You know, they're not tied down by the same life experiences that we have been growing up. They know there's green technologies out there that can be used. They know there's these global issues, and they want to fix them. Every one of them is, as soon as they hear, what can I do? What can I do? So I do think there's a lot of hope.
So I hear you saying that that reversibility is potentially possible at this point, and that we have not tipped yet. And then we have 2 to 3 decades of time to turn this around. Is that?
That would be my view on it. And you know, the question also said, what would a tipping point look like if we do go over the edge? And you know, a lot of people, you talk about a tipping point, they think, oh my God, we're all going to die. Probably not. But what my version of a tipping point is, as I said earlier, that the bad things we presently know are in the world begin to get a lot more frequent, and the good things that we love about the world are harder and harder to come by. Rather than seeing more and more people pulled up out of that porous 3 billion, we see more and more people tipping into that porous 3 billion. So that's what a tipping point looks like. And yes, along with that are wars, disease. But I do think that we have enough foresight and enough knowledge and enough empathy and caring as human beings to go in the other direction.
Talk, if you could, about Jerry Brown and some of the behind-the-scenes negotiations that led to that consensus. Those of you might remember the consensus statement, which you referenced in your talk. What made that happen? Because it truly was extraordinary.
You should start because you have the best story at the beginning.
Yeah.
Well, so as Liz mentioned, we wrote this kind of nerdy science paper and thought that would be the end of it, and all these news outlets picked up on it, and Jerry Brown apparently read one of those. And one day I was out running with my dogs, and my cell phone rang, and I thought, oh, what have my kids done now? So I picked it up, and on the other end of the line was, do you have time to speak with Governor Brown right now? So I paused a little bit and said, yes. So anyway, long story short, that was an initial conversation in which he said, okay, is this, tell me about this. It sounds pretty alarming. Why aren't you scientists shouting this from the roof? And I said, well, I thought we were. And he kind of laughed and said, look, I'm a politician. I haven't heard this in this way before. I can actually do something about this stuff if you guys work with me. So why don't you put together a group, which we did, and started building a consensus of scientists that he could draw on and use in working with the various people that he works with.
One of the wonderful things about that, so we learned a lot about how to communicate science from Jerry Brown, and he didn't have anything to do with the content. He and his staff worked a lot with, they wanted a one-page summary. They didn't want any jargon. So the standard things you learn about when you're trying to communicate science. But then he just made, in fact, there were stories of us Xeroxing copies of this consensus statement and taking them to Sacramento. Eventually, they learned how to do that on their own. But the point is that he carried boxes of these things around, and we had them translated into Chinese, Nepali, Portuguese, Spanish, French. I'm sure I'm missing some languages. And he just took them everywhere. He gave them to business leaders. He gave them to governors. He gave them to presidents. That picture of him with President Xi at that meeting, he actually gave him a copy of the consensus statement in Chinese. And His staff, we've worked on and off with Governor Brown, but his staff is remarkable. So in the Office of Planning and Research, they have a team of people that are, you know, they're just amazing. You know, I can't believe how good these people are. And they all individually are committed to making a difference. There are teams of people that are thinking about not just the kinds of climate issues that we're going to be confronted with in California, in fact, that we already are being confronted with, water, massive death of our forests and trees, really big issues with, for example, our fisheries, huge economic issues. But they're also dealing with adaptation. The thing that I've learned from Governor Brown, and this is probably my biggest message tonight and always, and really the hopeful sign that I have, is that it really does start at the community level. It doesn't start at the national level. There's a lot of leadership. There's a lot of things that can be set up there. But basically, no individual leader has the ability to really make the difference themselves. Whereas at the community level, you know, planting the right trees, thinking about what kind of water infrastructure, what kind of sewage infrastructure, what kind of houses are you going to build for the future? You know, who's going to be set up for solar power? Who will not be? Those kinds of questions are being addressed by staff in Governor Brown's office. And so I have to say that they're thinking about the future and adaptation for our communities, and we should be thinking about it as well.
So there were policy recommendations that came out of this that you think could be implemented and are being implemented. I mean, it raises the question, where do we go from here? And I hear you saying a lot.
I hope so.
Terrific. What would you like to hear from our national leaders, given particularly today's news about the future of the GOP?
What would we not like to hear?
I would like to hear that our next president is deeply engaged with the leaders of other nations around the world to address these global problems, climate change, inequality, poverty, and that we're moving forward as a global society rather than building walls and going back to a nationalist sort of mentality.
Anything you'd like to add?
I think that's really, I guess that's what I see. There are a lot of really good ideas out there, but I think the world is increasingly global. There's no nation that is completely self-sufficient. There's no way. You know, the world is changing. We talked about population, and somebody asked the question about deaths and births. There's also demography. So the pyramid of how, you know, where are our leaders? In Japan, you know, the leaders, the elders, that's most of the country. There are more adult diapers sold in Japan than there are infant diapers, right? But in Africa, it's exactly the opposite. The average age is, their elders are in their 20s. And so there's no wisdom. There's no kind of collective leadership. And it's these young people that are all fighting for their lives. So I think part of the transition, you know, is and in leadership is just the appreciation for the diversity and the wonder of the world, the complete commitment to the fact that we can't go forward into our global future without each other. We just can't. And so I think global leadership is absolutely critical.
Are there other examples of nations that have done it well or that could be thought leaders in this?
So Reunion is virtually, they're headed to be completely self-sufficient. Denmark.
Reunion. Okay. Denmark.
Mauritius has done an incredible job with population, and they've staved off biodiversity loss because of that. Many of the Scandinavian countries are very innovative when it comes to their governments, but remember also that many of these countries are dependent upon resources from outside their borders. So they do have to establish really important trade agreements, and they have to be appreciative of their neighbors as well.
The issue of the economy with climate change often comes up, and there was a survey released today, actually, saying that people feared the cost of the economy if we were to wean ourselves of fossil fuels. Address that, if you could.
Sure. So, you know, it's that's a pervasive fear, but when you actually look at the facts, it absolutely does not hold. There were more new jobs created in the renewable energy industry than in the fossil fuel industry every year for the past several years. And we're not talking by one or two jobs. We're talking by thousands, right? So as far as a job creator and generator, it's a no-brainer, right? So I think those are the sorts of messages that need to get out to the general public and overcome these misperceptions.
So California, again, you know, we're one of the greenest states, and we our economy is doing quite well. We are, depending on when you look at it, something like the seventh largest economy in the world. So we're bigger than most countries in the world, and we rely on, we're increasingly relying more and more on green technology. I think another thing to think about and keep in mind is the investment isn't in a resource. The investment is in the technology to harness that resource. So fossil fuels are a resource that has an end, that has a process, that has a pinch point. You know, solar energy does not. It's the technology to acquire it, but there's no limit to it. And so that's another way of thinking about renewables, is that it's really not the resource you're investing in, it's the technology. And then finally, I'll bring our own personal example. We went through this, we've been talking about doing this for a long time, but our own investments for our retirement, there are actually amazing opportunities to invest in green technologies. And we are in the process of, we're in the process of transitioning to a portfolio that is guaranteed to get us as much of an interest rate as we've had our entire past several years since 2008, since the recession. And so it is possible. It takes work. It takes asking the right kind of questions, and it takes, you know, an investment partner that's willing to do the work. But even for your own investments, it's a wise thing to do.
Thank you. Which leads us to our last question. Unfortunately, we're at that point in the program of what can we do as individuals? And I think the message from your book was, and you showed us the 60% up there, is that if everyone just talks to someone else and just keep the conversation going.
Absolutely. That's my message, is cooperation. You know, it's basically a small world after all, and we can just start right here in our communities. I think it's a really important thing.
Anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just like in the little movie clip we saw, you don't start with let's change the world because that's too grand. You start with what can I do in my own backyard? Who can I vote for? Those are the things that make a difference. And as Liz said, just communicating these messages to your peer groups, because you're the one who has the messaging power within your peer group. You're the one that they're going to believe.
Thank you so much. So I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program, brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Really encourage you to come up and talk to the speakers more afterwards. We'd like to thank Dr. Anthony Barnosky and Dr. Elizabeth Hadley, the authors of the book Tipping Point for Planet Earth, How Close Are We to the Edge? I'd like to thank our audience here in Palo Alto, and also for those of you joining us on radio and the web. So now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.